WBM, we haven't heard from or had with us for quite a while, David Kahn. David, thank you so much for joining us.
A pleasure to be here.
David, exciting news. You had a conference in Houston, Texas. Just a couple of Fairfax Radio. You're on the Commons. I'm Shu Bartholomew. And joining me on the Commons today, we have an old friend some weeks ago.
We did.
And it was wonderful. I was so blessed. I was fortunate that I was invited and I was able to come. And considering what Houston had just been through, I thought it was marvelous.
Yeah, you know, you were our honored guest. And I should be clear, it's the Texas HOA Reform Group that had the conference. We had what was, I think, special for Texas is that we brought in, I'm going to say, about 50 people, and many of whom were from the Harris County area. That's the area right around Houston where, at least some of us believe, the worst problems emerged first. But we also now have really good representation from Austin, which happens to be our state capital, San Antonio, and we had people from Dallas, the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and then we had a few additional people from scattered sites. As you know, Texas is a fairly large state, and unfortunately the problems are metastasizing, and so I was really pleased to see so many people who made a great deal of effort to come together, and all of these people have extensive experience. So this is if you will, part of the leadership, this would be the homeowner leadership from across the state. And we shared ideas for a whole day. You know, of course, to prepare for the conference, we had come up with what the planners thought were maybe the top 20 issues to discuss. And I think we got an additional 10 issues. I mean, it's very important to be able to hear and have everybody interact with each other. We covered both single-family detached homes and the issues that are also in condominiums, some of which are the same, some of which are a little bit different. We had, you know, personal experiences. People were sharing their personal experiences and also sharing the personal experiences of folks who they had helped. We have a number of people who, as veterans of the resistance, are now able to help their neighbors, and that's of course, excellent as well. And I should add, Shu, that the day before the conference, This conference was put on largely by the Texas HOA Reform Group with co-sponsorship from St. Thomas University, their Social Justice Committee, and it was wonderful to reach into that community for some additional support, and also by the League of Women Voters. And the day before this conference, I had the privilege to address the League of Women Voters in the Harris County area. We had almost no overlap. We had a few. Some of the leadership from the league was in both places, but maybe another 60 or 70 people at the meeting of the League of Women Voters, and they seem poised to join us in advocating for protection of homeowner rights. So all of that is very exciting as we gear up for a legislative session that starts in January.
I think that's wonderful, and I think, you know, we really need to reach across the aisle, basically, to other organizations and work in tandem with them, because on our own I don't think we're going to be able to do it. What was really nice, I thought, David, was first of all meeting all the people that I had spoken to over the years and emailed. I mean, all of a sudden they were real. They were sitting right there in the same room. They were participating. They were sharing their experiences. They were talking about the problems and talking about what they wanted to see done and what needed to be done. Also, you sort of broke out and people came up to me at various times and started talking about their particular issues and asking me questions. I thought that was so important because, number one, people no longer feel they're alone, and a lot of people who are having problems with their associations tend to feel that they're all alone, that this is not happening to anyone else. And that in and of itself, I thought, was so valuable to bring people together.
Well, I agree totally with that. And I think that by the time some of us got into this, we were already a decade or more behind the you know, behind the ball, the CAI and the over aggressive lawyers, over aggressive managers across the country really have had a huge head start. And I think that, you know, one of the things we've seen over the last 5 years, maybe a little bit more, is nascent organizations, emerging organizations, just as you described, that are starting to bring homeowners together and then starting to get to the next level. And you had mentioned that this is perhaps the fourth conference, statewide conference of homeowners, and so, and that's in some pretty big states. So we have we've had conferences in California and New Jersey and Florida and now Texas, and bringing, uniting people and help, you know, sharing experiences, learning from each other, supporting each other, all those points that you just made, is terrific. And I think that what's real important is to be able to build an ongoing framework so that we can continue to do this, and also we're going to need the legislative strength that comes from being truly statewide organizations, and that's true in each of the states, I feel. And you know, the problems, you know, are of course seem the most the greatest. So I would say Texas has huge problems, but we're starting to fight back, and we're doing it with some just terrific people. And I think that one of the things that I got out of it was just how strong each of the people who joined together, how strong each person is. And that strength, when we get even, you know, when we act collectively, is even more so.
Well, what I found particularly interesting, David, was the fact that so many people had different little areas of expertise that they were willing to share. So it kind of added to the patchwork quilt that we are building across the country. I thought that was really wonderful.
Well, I agree with that. That's a very important point. And so we have, for example, one of the fellows who you saw, Mr. Adolph, and he got up and explained that wonderful database where they're
right,
literally counting every lawsuit filed against homeowners. And that
is it the lawsuits or it's the foreclosures?
Well, it's the lawsuits that where they assert a claim for foreclosures.
Okay.
And you're absolutely right. There are, in fact, more lawsuits than lawsuits that assert foreclosures. But even so, it's thousands and thousands every year. And he was just counting them in Harris County.
Right. And just HOAs, not condos, too.
That's correct. Just the single family subdivisions and and he didn't even quite get all of the courts where they were filed. But what's important here is to expose this, you know, turn over the rock, show what's underneath. When we were in the legislative negotiations 2 years ago, in Texas, that's how long you have to wait. It's every 2 years. When we were in negotiations 2 years ago, we actually got some legislators to support the idea that there should be a public listing of lawsuits filed by associations. And that way, if I were to go or you were to go and think about buying a home in a subdivision, you could see easily whether this is a subdivision that solves its problems, whatever they may be, that addresses its disputes or its concerns in a neighborly way, or whether this is a heavy-handed, lawyer-manager-driven, we go to court at the drop of a hat kind of a lawsuit. And literally what we were told was by a lawyer who brings a lot of these lawsuits, he said, but if you publish that list, no one would buy in the subdivision. And that's the point. So we're gathering the data to prove, or updating the data to prove. Bob is doing that. Adolph is gathering that data, and his family gathering that data to prove the extent of the problem, because legislators really need to see what's happening often under the radar. So it was we had a number of examples such as that. We had people who had. One of the other problems you mentioned is that, you know, whatever happens to you in isolation. And so it's not always easy to see that what has happened in your subdivision is systematically being done in many subdivisions, but in fact in Texas and
across the country,
elsewhere.
Across the country, David.
Right. One of the prominent management companies is, or it's really a network now of management companies, is doing the same thing over and over again, or the same things, because there are multiple tactics that they're employing to gain leverage against homeowners. And so to expose that and to show, to document the connections and the commonalities of the abuses, you know, the same abuses are perpetrated again and again in multiple subdivisions. I think that's very powerful and is setting us up for a good and hopefully successful legislative session. So that was really a very upbeat and energizing event. And, you know, at the end of the day, everybody was just it appeared to have as much energy as when they started. I had lost my voice. It was wonderful.
I know. It was a long day. It was very intense. It started at 8:30 in the morning and went until 5 at night. And it was great. It was really, really wonderful. From a personal observation, I mean, flying into Houston, I sort of, as we started our descent into the city, I looked out of the window and I could see all these blue roofs. And at first I thought, odd. I mean, I've seen red roofs, but I don't think I've seen that many blue roofs. It suddenly dawned on me as I got a little closer that they weren't blue roofs, but they were tarps. And that was a reminder that you guys were still digging out and still had the ravages of Ike to deal with. And yet, despite that, people came. Some people couldn't stay all day. They came for as much as, you know, for as long as they could. And some people came for early morning and stayed all day, but the energy was wonderful.
Yeah, I think those of us who went through Ike and then survived and then went on to this, I think it was liberating to be able to focus on something new. And the you're absolutely right. Of course, Ike generated its own share of horror stories. We had got a call from one of the consumer reporters at a TV station saying, can they do this? And it was a situation where a man still didn't have his power on. You may or may not know that although some people got their power back fast, for some people it took 2 weeks.
It took more than 2 weeks.
He didn't have his power back on, and they wanted him to cut up the trees in his yard and stack them, you know, neatly in piles by the road, and there was nobody to be hired. Everybody was who could be doing this stuff was largely at work for the city and the county, you know, cleaning the roads, etc. So one hopes that cooler heads eventually prevailed, but it's just stunning how those who are inclined to abuse their power, everything is an opportunity, and it's sad.
It is. Well, it was wonderful. I'm still sort of glowing in the warmth of the afterglow, if you will, of having met everyone and having been with you guys. I sort of hope that more states continue to have these. I think they're wonderful. But you were telling me you had some stuff going on in Clear Lakes that you wanted to talk about.
Well, I think that we have probably mentioned this maybe the last time I was on, but it would have been a while ago when we started this. It actually turned out to be a pair of lawsuits, but the lawsuits came after, and this is a real important point, I think, you know, to stress, came after organizing by homeowners in the Clear Lake City Community Association, which is a rather large, multiple thousand member homeowner, is more accurate, multiple thousand homeowners to the south of Houston, actually, within Houston now. And
is this a city or is it on an HOA?
It's a homeowners association, and it became part of the city of Houston, and that turned out to be important for one of the issues in the dispute. But Clear Lake City Community Association was created a couple decades ago under a fairly unusual structure where they claimed that the homeowners were not members, although the homeowners did have rights to vote for directors. And for our purposes, the Clear Lake City Community Association is a subdivision that was created in a sort of unusual set of historical circumstances a couple decades ago. And it has some oddities, such as their deed restrictions say that homeowners are not members. It's not a membership corporation. But the homeowners do vote for the directors. And for the purposes of our discussion today, I don't think those oddities matter. After several decades, a group took over the board of directors. They were elected. And what began to emerge was a pattern of problems. Multiple complaints by homeowners began to be heard. This was long before I got involved. And they were complaints about unequal treatment. So some homeowners were being cited for violations where others in the same circumstances were being left alone. In particular, board members seemed to be getting better treatment, and the board members passed special rules to enable them to conduct activities that might otherwise be forbidden. There were complaints that there were charges, the assessments had been raised beyond that allowed by the deed restrictions. And these, in that sense, this association became typical of other associations where homeowners have complaints about their board. So in response to these complaints, as has happened as well in other organizations, in other communities, critics emerged. A number of homeowners recognized various problems and spoke out, which was terrific. And then they began to perceive retaliation in the form of complaints that the association cited them for example. And both of the lawsuits that we're going to discuss in a moment, the families involved received violation notices that they felt were unjust. You may agree after you hear about them. In addition to the unjust violation notices, there were complaints that these violation notices were being used to deprive people, homeowners, of the right to vote. And we've seen this in other in other communities. The violation letters are sent, and then before the homeowner, they're sent right before the
annual election.
Annual election, exactly. And then, in addition to that, in addition to the odd, to put it nicely, timing of the violation notices and the dubious, at least from the homeowner's perspective, dubious nature of the violation notices, it was the critics asserted that the homeowners association did not have the right to deny voting power to homeowners. It was not provided for in the deed restrictions. Now, you may not be surprised to hear that the next thing that happened, or one of the next things that happened in this sequence of events, was that the incumbent board began to amend deed restrictions to, or excuse me, amend bylaws to increase its
powers,
self-control.
Right.
Exactly. And so, in response to, at about the same time, and in response to some of these bylaw amendments, and in response to the other criticisms, with respect to, you know, the original criticisms, that is to say, the arbitrary treatment and the complaints about charges being too high, and in response to the perceived retaliation, a number of people began to run for office as what might be thought of as dissident board members. And a piece of the board's reaction to that, they took steps to prevent people from running for office by claiming that since some homeowners had received violation notices, they could not run for office. That was related to the problems with the voting. And they, when homeowners were elected to the board, other board members voted them off.
Just like that. We don't want you on the board, so off you go. Goodbye.
Well, they, you know, they had some piece of paper purporting to justify this. And and one of the things that was you know, disturbing is that these board members are, in fact, getting legal advice from someone saying that what they are doing is authorized. And so at this point, I think I want to describe briefly the two the two situations that existed before the lawsuits are two different families. One is the Gates family, the other is the Toppin family. Describe them briefly and then describe what happened, and then see, you know, make a couple comments I'll have about what we may have learned from this.
Okay.
So the Gates situation, in addition to the sort of general complaints that I've mentioned before, one of the issues in the community had to do with safe sidewalks. And some of the sidewalks in the subdivision apparently were not in particularly good shape, and actually the Gates family suggested that the subdivision might look to the city for certain funding that was available to repair sidewalks. And, in fact, eventually the association did do this. And then they repaired many of the sidewalk segments in the subdivision, including the sidewalk segment or parts of the sidewalk in front on the street where the Gates family lives. But when they repaired that sidewalk, they skipped the part of the sidewalk that was immediately in front of the Gates property. And that was done in the mid to late 90s. But then as the criticism heated up, the Gates much later received a notice saying your sidewalk segment, and it wasn't their sidewalk segment, but the assertion was your sidewalk segment is not up to par, you need to fix it. And in addition, you need to pay money for the fact that the lawyer wrote this letter. And the Gates disputed both. They said we have no duty to fix this. They also said there's nothing that needs fixing. But we don't, in any event, it's not, the sidewalk is not on our property. And you don't have a legal right to charge us the legal fees. And again, this, although the sidewalk complaint may be somewhat novel, it's fairly common, at least in Texas, for the lawyers to assert a demand for legal fees.
Right.
Where, to put it nicely, it's doubtful that they have that authority. We denied that they had any such authority. And as you can no doubt foresee, when the Gates family then went to pay their assessment, and specifically declined to pay, refused to pay, if you will, the charge for the lawyer's fee, they got into a tussle, and the association literally had someone write on the check that the Gates family had sent in on account, and then they credited the money to pay the lawyer's fee and left a piece of the assessment unpaid, and that you can foresee is leading up to a foreclosure lawsuit.
That happens all the time, David. It happens from all over the country. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, and so one of that common problem is in fact one of the things that interested me about the case. How do we challenge that? And in Texas, the way the situation is, you have to sue first. And that's just because if you sue first, you have a hope of getting your attorney fees. If the association sues first, you, in many, many cases, it's nearly impossible, very difficult to recover your attorney fees. So you have to have some affirmative claim. You can counterclaim sometimes. But putting the legal niceties aside, as a practical matter, you should sue first, and the Gates family did, seeking a declaration that the association had no right to demand these repairs and no right to collect the legal fees. And then we amended the complaint to also include one of the really big issues in the community, which had to do with the level of annual assessments, which had been raised beyond, we claim, beyond the very clear limits set in the deed restrictions. And so that's our first lawsuit. There were related issues as well, because based on the alleged violation concerning the sidewalk, which the Gates family denied, the Gates family had been denied the right to vote. And there were Their friends had been denied the right to run for office, and that became an issue in the second case involving the Toppin family. Ms. Toppin had been trying, among other people, to run for office over the course of several years. I think it was about a half dozen years that she and or a friend of hers had attempted to run for office, and either they had not been allowed to run in some years because of alleged violations, or they had lost, but at least Ms. Toppin came close to winning. And so after one of her near misses, the association put in a bylaw amendment that said, in the case of a tie, the board gets to choose.
Decide, right?
Yeah.
Who breaks the tie? Good
yeah.
for them.
Okay. And let me see. You know, I honestly can't remember whether they put that in, whether they did it as a bylaw amendment, or whether they did it as a, they simply did it as a board resolution. I'm not even sure. In any event, what eventually came to pass that Ms. Toppin ran and did tie. When after the tie vote, the board did in fact choose her opponent, who was the incumbent, to continue in his seat. And we felt that this was inappropriate, that the deed restrictions very clearly said you use the government code to determine, the election code to determine the outcome of tied elections, and as applied in this case, a tied election, you have to have a do-over, a new vote. And when the board refused to do that, Ms. Toppin sued. The Toppin suit is one of my favorite lawsuits that I've brought in homeowner associations. It settled very rapidly, and I can't tell you the exact terms of the settlement. That's confidential. But I can tell you that there was, in fact, a new election. And in the new election, Ms. Toppin won with approximately 60% of the votes. And shortly after Ms. Toppin won her seat, other longtime incumbent members of the board began to resign. And then they were successively replaced in new elections. The other thing that happened at about the same time, or just before the Toppin election, was that one of the local state legislators became aware of the problems in this particular subdivision, and one of our rare successes in the legislature, he got the state of Texas to enact a statute that for subdivisions that look an awful lot like Clear Lake Community Civic Association or Clear Lake City Community Association, they have to abide by state laws that make meetings open and state laws that make records available. And that was a huge victory. It's one we'd like to see extended far beyond, but at least for this subdivision, they have to follow the Open Meetings Act and the Open Records Act. And so with Ms. Toppin's victory and with that statute and with the resignation and the replacement with new homeowners, some of the problems began to get resolved. And one of the problems that eventually was resolved was the issue of the assessments. And the issue of the assessments had been, there had been, basically what was happening was the assessment had been capped at a certain amount of money, and that was being charged. And in addition, the association was charging an additional amount of money to collect garbage. And suffice it to say that, although, again, I can't tell you the terms of the settlement with the Gates family, the public records show that the association, in fact, voted to rescind the additional charge for garbage and is now operating with a charge of just what the capped assessment is. And so we resolved that matter. And at least as of the last time I looked, the sidewalk hasn't been, nothing has been done to the sidewalk.
Did it need to be done? Was there a problem with the sidewalk? Wasn't it fixed when the rest of it was done?
I will tell you, I went and looked at the sidewalk, and I didn't see a problem with it. And I will tell you that the Gates family is a, you know, careful, attentive family with two children, and it's their own children who walk and ride on that segment of sidewalk, and they didn't see any problem with the sidewalk. You know, I haven't been back there recently. The Gates family moved. But the point that I wanted then to get to, the point is that it took a lot of energy to respond to these practices where we had homeowners initially all by themselves, you know, feeling like they were being victimized. And they made complaints and they heard each other and they began to come together. And they rallied behind people who were willing to stick their neck out and run for office, which is just, it's incredibly important for people to be willing to do that. And they rallied behind people who were willing to speak up and to propose constructive solutions, such as finding the funds finding the city funds to repair the sidewalk. They rallied behind the Gates family and behind the Toppin family. And that's what has made the change possible in the subdivision. The mechanism of change, the communities being organized, being able to get to reach their state legislature. I mean, you know, none of these are wealthy people. Nobody is making, corporate-sized campaign contributions. As far as I know, nobody made any campaign contributions, although I don't know that. I didn't look. But the local legislator was simply persuaded by the merits of the homeowners' criticisms, saying that this is not fair, that for a group that takes our money, we should be able to see the records, we should be able to attend the meetings, we should be able to elect homeowners of our choice.
But that's part of democracy, isn't it?
That is part of democracy. I was listening to the radio the other day, and it's one of the things that the commenter was stressing was democracy is not a spectator sport.
Right.
We are participants. It is our rights. And if our votes don't get counted, we are the ones who suffer. It's not like we're watching a movie. It's not happening to someone else. And so it becomes critically important that the homeowners speak up, pull together, find people who are willing to stand up and run for office. Focus on the important issues. You know, there were lots and lots of criticisms. And I think one of the reasons that...
What, by the homeowners about the association?
Yeah.
Or the association about the homeowners? They're both.
Well, probably both. But what I care about is that there were many different homeowners had complaints about the association. And what I think the vocal critics were able to distill was, here are some important issues based on which we can stand up and be counted. We can run for office, and we can make changes. And I'll tell you that even with the new board, change has come slowly. I think, you know, responsible homeowners are a cautious lot, but change does come, and it's, I think, a better community because of it.
David, I want to go back to something you said earlier, and I want to talk a little bit about that. You said in Texas we have to sue first, because if the law is written, the way I understand it, the law is written that if you sue, then you have a chance to recoup your attorney fees. If the association had sued the homeowner first, then there was no chance of the association covering the homeowner's fees. They were stuck, right?
Well, that's a slight overstatement of the law, but in practice it's mostly true. The slight overstatement is, if one could prove, for example, that the association, if it sued first and was frivolous, then one might be able to recover attorney fees. But the problem is that proving something to be frivolous is a very demanding standard, and how much time and energy does a homeowner want to spend carrying a case forward just to litigate over attorney fees? You don't want to do that. You want to be done and get out. There are other ways. For example, theoretically, in some circumstances, the homeowner can file a counterclaim, which is akin to suing first. But basically, in Texas, the rule in practice is what you said.
Well, I've had a lot of attorney friends over the years, and they've always told me that it's better to let the other person sue you because they'll have the burden of proof. So my question is, but the way the law is written, is it putting the homeowners at a disadvantage?
Yes. And I think that your other attorney friends, the one you referred to there, are largely correct, and there's another reason. We should not rush to court. That is one of the things that homeowners criticize associations for is they go to court too fast. That associations should find other ways to resolve disputes. Well, we don't want to be in the position where we're rushing to court too fast. And the problem is that this puts the homeowner to a difficult decision. If you want to be able to recover your attorney fees, anybody who calls me, it's simple enough. I give them this advice. If you want to be able to recover attorney fees, as a practical matter, you are far better off if you sue first. But then you do have the burden of having been the person who brought this matter in front of the jury in the first place.
Right.
Most jurors are sympathetic to a homeowner's desire to avoid going to court. The problem is if the homeowner waits until they are sued, it becomes difficult or impossible to recover attorney fees. It's not impossible. There are circumstances under which it can be done, but it can be very difficult.
See, in Virginia, it says the prevailing party. So it doesn't matter who goes first. So as a homeowner, you can sit back and let the association have to bear the burden of proof and sue you first.
Yeah, that's not, I have to tell you, that although that's much better, that's not a great boon for the homeowner because
they're still
stuck in a situation where they're spending their own money, and they almost all of us have something better to do than hire an attorney, and the association is spending all of the homeowner's money.
Right.
And so it's much less of a burden on the association. So in fact, the homeowner, it's not a level playing field just because you say whoever wins gets their attorney fees back. But it is better because in Texas, it's even more unequal.
No, that's the point I was making. No, it's wrong because I think that the homeowners are at a great disadvantage. I don't think you're going to disagree with that, or any reasonable person listening in today is going to say, Sue, you're just really, unless it's members of the industry, and they do tell me I'm a little off the wall on some of my issues, but. You know, if they didn't say that, I wouldn't
stay
feel
off
like,
the wall. Sure.
I know. If they didn't tell me that, I wouldn't know that I was on the right track, so to speak. So, the other thing I wanted to talk a little bit about, David, is this is another huge problem. You send in your check. There are two problems. The homeowner sends in their check like they're supposed to send in the check, and for your assessment. And that money is misapplied, in my opinion, and goes to cover fines, legal fees, interest, and all kinds of other charges that can be questionable. Because I hear from people who say, there's a lien filed against me, against my property, and for some alleged violation, I have no idea. They won't tell me what I violated.
Well, we had one of those it's amazing. We had one of those just the other day. It's you really put together two problems. One of them is the misapplication of the payment. And Texas common law does seem to say, at least in my opinion, that if a homeowner says, apply my payments this way, the association has to do that. But associations have lawyers who disagree with me, and until we get a case that squarely decides that, homeowners are at risk. Again, associations aren't at risk. There is no big loss to an association. An association doesn't have a family that they need to go home to at night. An association doesn't have to feed a mouth. An association simply has a collection of people that employ lawyers and managers. And the worst that happens is that the manager is, they said, well, we were aggressive and we lost, but the intimidation value is sometimes worth it to the lawyer, the association, and to those who wish to be in control. But the second of those problems, it's astounding to me. We just, a woman who came to the conference, and she showed a letter which said, it's in a condominium association, dear ma'am, this is from a lawyer. This is to inform you that your conduct is in violation of the deed restrictions. You are misstating information provided to you from the association, and you are otherwise violating various deed restrictions. Cease and desist, and by the way, pay the attorneys $175. And she hasn't got a clue as to what allegedly she did wrong, and she has in fact sent a letter back saying, you know, let me know what it is I've done wrong, and if I've done something wrong, I'll surely apologize to anyone, but I don't think I've done anything wrong, and I certainly know of no basis for the association to be charging me money. And it's quite disturbing because, you know, for the vast majority of people, when they get a letter from a lawyer that says, and by the way, pay me $175, what are they supposed to do? Because you can't go to another lawyer and say, you know, let's go litigate over this $175 uh-huh. bill. It's going to cost $175 or much more just to get the lawyer to look at your letter and to give you the advice that, well, you really don't want to hire me because it's going to cost you hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of dollars to fight a $175 bill. What are you going to do? But that's what gets people in the trap that then as the next letter it's, you know, $300, and then the next letter it's $500, and with the lawsuit it's $2,500, and there are people who have literally paid thousands of dollars because they...
Look at our friend, $1 million, Monica.
Yes, in a particularly extended set of circumstances where she actually fought back in court. The vast majority, and I don't know how much Monica has spent, but it certainly is great gobs of money. The vast majority of people, once they get to court, finally realize they can't play in this league. Most of us just don't have that kind of money to hire lawyers. And we don't have that much money to lose. And so I think back to one of the women I worked with a number of years ago, and you know, there were, of course, by the end, many disputes, but at the beginning, the dispute was over the fact that the basketball hoop at her house didn't have a net. And, I mean, she was disabled, but her sons had played there until they went to college, and it just didn't make sense to her to go way out of her way to put up a net. It just wasn't high on her priority list. She, you know, her husband wasn't there. She was, you know, living alone, disabled. There were things she had to actually do with her life. To be sued over a missing picket in her fence and the missing net on her basketball hoop, and it ended up the sensible advice that she got eventually from another lawyer was pay the $8,000 or something like that dollars in legal fees. I came into it much after that. There was nothing we could do about that that payment. She actually paid it. She lost it. It's gone. It enriched some lawyer who didn't need the money, came out of her retirement account, withdrawn on a penalty.
Going back to, you know, this misappropriation of funds, which is basically what it is. I mean, this is, in my opinion, it's both a moral and an ethical issue, because a homeowners association or condominium or however this thing is, it's designed for the collective and everybody pays their share. So when the association takes your share of your common expenses and then applies it to something that has nothing to do with maintaining the association itself, isn't there a moral issue here? Isn't it an ethical problem? Because then they're forcing other people to pay double to maintain the budget. In some cases.
Well, I guess it's easy for me to say, sure, it's a moral issue, sure, it's an ethical issue. I think abuse of power is always a moral and ethical issue. But from my perspective, where we sit today in Texas, there are two problems. Some of what the associations do, however morally discouraging or despicable they may be, are in fact allowed.
By law.
By law. What we need to do is change the law, because the problem is that what they are doing is offensive, abusive, improper,
It's reprehensible.
But it's legal. And that is one set of problems. Now, there's a completely different set of problems where the associations do things that are, in fact, not legal. So at least we have the right to go to court in these cases where the homeowners have been denied their right to run for office or to hold office or to pay a capped annual assessment. We can go to court for some things, but for other things we can't go to court because the conduct is in fact permitted. And so, for example, if you have someone who falls behind a couple hundred dollars on their assessments because maybe their wife dies or their kid is sick or they get divorced or anyone of, in this terrible economy, they can lose their job, all sorts of reasons why someone might not have quite enough money to pay all their bills. And if they choose to say, let's pay the doctor first, let's pay the college tuition bill first, let's pay the food bill first, let's pay the bank mortgage first, and if they don't pay the association and the association then says, well, you're late, we're charging you in addition to a late fee, if the association wanted to charge a few dollars interest for late payments, I might or might not be happy, but I wouldn't consider it a massive problem. But what they do is they say, well, pay interest or not, depending on their particular practice, but also pay this, this fee for the lawyers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it has no reason to be. The homeowners ought to be able to get a payment plan of some sort that makes sense given their particular circumstances. And in well-run associations, payment plans are routinely offered. There are associations that do this. We didn't invent this concept. This concept comes from associations where they try to solve at least some of their problems without going to court. And, I would like to say those associations should be commended, except how much commendation does someone need for common sense?
Well, for doing the right thing.
But in Texas, at least, they deserve commendation because so many take unfair advantage of that to demand and often successfully collect legal fees.
And they become the collection agencies for the attorneys, basically.
Well, and often this is a time when someone is in their, they're most vulnerable.
Right. This is community for you.
Well, because, these are people who typically they would pay the bill if they could. Now, there are some who don't, and, I have relatively little sympathy for them, and I don't represent them, et cetera. But most people, if they could pay their bills, would do so. And the rush to sue, the rush to impose attorney fees before lawsuits and, the other associated charges, such as for the filing of a lien, several hundred dollars at a pop, we really need to try to stop that. And I getting back to your comment at the beginning about the conference, I think that we're in a good position to at least correct some of the abuses and make that conduct illegal. That's what we want to do. We want to make it illegal this session.
Let's take that one step further. And we talked about misapplying the funds, but how about associations that refuse to accept a check?
And well,
they send it back.
Yeah, that happens too.
Should they be allowed to do that, David? Is there a legal basis for doing that?
Under some circumstances, the answer would be yes. So, for example, if you say you wanted to sell your car and you just sold it on the street to somebody else, and the deal was the person is going to pay you $1,000 now and $1,000 in 6 weeks. So for whatever reason, you think that's a fair deal, they think that's a fair deal, you sign a very straightforward contract, and at the end of the 6 weeks, the person says, well, I really don't want to pay you $1,000. Here's the check for $500 marked paid in full, okay? And if you were given such a check and you feel, oh, I should get my full $1,000, yeah, you can refuse that check. And under some circumstances, an association, if they have a legitimate, say their annual assessment is $200 a year, and typically, often enough anyway, people understand they have to pay the annual assessment. If they then came at the appointed time and said, here's $100 paid in full, as in I'm never going to pay you the other $100, and by cashing this check, you are accepting it as full payment. No, the association does not have to accept the money.
But most people are not sophisticated enough to say this.
That almost never happens.
They just write the check in the association. For instance, in Winona Blevins' case, I mean, she wrote a check for the full amount that they asked for, which included 2 years' worth of assessments, late fees, interest, and all the other stuff. And they yet refuse to accept it.
Well, and so, I mean, I give that example to show the absurdity of the situation, such as Ms. Blevins or such as other people, where what's really at issue is that there is a dispute as to something that does not have to do with the assessment. So often enough, you'll have someone like the Gates family go back to their situation. They were willing to pay the entire assessment. They wrote a check. And they said, use this to pay for the assessment. And in their particular case, they wrote a very clear cover letter that says, I dispute your right to collect the attorney fee. Do not use this money for that. They were distinct charges. And under Texas law, at least, and I think it's fairly uniform, the association should, in my legal opinion, have accepted and cashed that check, credited it to pay down the assessment, and then the association would still have their claim, however meritorious or however unmeritorious that claim would be, for the additional legal fee. And that is really what should happen across the board. And then if people want to dispute particular debts, they can do so. I'd prefer to have a situation where a homeowner can actually pay that disputed amount, and then if the homeowner decides to sue to get it back, depending on, so that the homeowner doesn't run the risk of adding charges. But the association should, when people say, here's my assessment money, the association should take that money, because the assessments typically are the things, as long as you pay that, you don't suffer foreclosure. At least in Texas, that is supposed to be the rule.
David, we're almost out of time, but congratulations. You won both cases in Clearwater.
Well, let me say the following. We settled both cases. The terms of the settlement are confidential. The ultimate result for the Clear Lake Community Association, which reflected a huge amount of work by the homeowners themselves, being brave enough to run for office, running and eventually winning. Some had won before and standing up, and then if they were thrown off, but then coming back, working with their local state representative, all of that has contributed to a much stronger community. And I think that's the important thing, that what we're doing is we're encouraging homeowners, at least what we're doing here in our little part of Texas, is encouraging homeowners to stand up for their rights, to have their communities serve them. They don't serve the community. The community exists to serve the homeowners.
Well said. David, thank you so very much for joining us. I know you're busy and you've taken time out of your day to be here. And congratulations on the Clear Lakes, and congratulations on a very successful conference.
Well, and Chu, we all very much appreciate, and I know from across the country, lots of people very much appreciate your work, both with the show and in being a behind-the-scenes organizer to make sure that we all keep our chin up and march on forward when it sometimes is difficult to do those things.
Oh, you got it. You can't give up hope.
Thank you.
You can't give up hope. Thanks to all of you for joining us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. Thanks again for joining us.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice 4HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.